Sharon. I serve as education coordinator. Welcome back to Bell Series on Fequa. If you don't have a handout, same handout that's been all week, but it's right here if you need one. Reminder that the session is recorded, so speak loudly if you're asking questions. That helps Jonah as he's editing. And also, there is a copy of the New Testament on reserve in the library. I mistakenly stole Hal's yesterday and put it back there, but we found it. And then there are also copies for sale in the store if you're so inclined. So welcome back, Hal. Today she baptizes herself, correct?
Okay. That's one of the things.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Hal.
Is anyone here for the first time this morning? Welcome into the middle of a deep stream that's going pretty fast. Please feel free to ask questions if you need to. So thanks again for coming. A couple of people have asked about the foreword to a New Testament, which was written by John Dominic Crossan. And in there, he talks about this quite amazing grotto in Ephesus, Turkey. And I thought we would sort of take a few minutes on this. So this is a 5th century painting from a cave that has been called, when it was found in the 19th century or early 20th century by archaeologists, it was called the Cave of Paul. So here you have Paul labeled there, Paulos, and here he is a teacher. And the really interesting thing about this, so this is a huge grotto underground in Ephesus on the side of a hill, and this is the main thing in this particular space. It's about this, I would say this is about life size. And so Paul is in the center. So over here you can see a part of a name for this person, and so that would be Theokleia. You all remember who Theokleia is?
Mother.
No, it's not mother. Thecla. It's her mother. So kind of weird, huh? That the bad mother has a big, is standing next to Paul, also with the sign of the teacher. Yeah, all of us are just kind of scratching our head about this. So she, of course, in the story, at least in the early story that we've been studying, she's the one who demands that Thecla herself be burned because she won't marry. But nevertheless, there is the Theokleia. One of the really interesting things about this, of course, is you'll see that the people over the years have blinded Theokleia. See that her eyes are marked out and her hands are taken off. So for instance, see, especially the gesture of her as teacher is removed. Now you could read that one of two ways, right? We know she's bad. Or it could be that this painting was made in a later version of Thecla in which she's not so bad. You may remember that in the last part of the story that we've been reading, in the Acts of Paul and Thecla, Thecla herself, near the end of her life, goes and wants to reconcile with her mother. And her mother refuses her. But there are other later versions of the story that have her being reconciled. Not that picture is always clarify things, right? But over here, this is, oh, and I can't find, there is a theta somewhere here, which begins the name of Thecla. So this is Thecla, who's been almost entirely scratched out. Or just maybe accidentally lost, who knows. But notice that who gets the building in this picture? It's Thecla. So that's probably her looking out the window to Paul, or it could be a particular shrine to her. I, frankly, since this has more questions than answers for me, this is simply one of many, this is probably the biggest picture of Thecla we have, but there are a lot of smaller pictures and stories, as I said, until about the 7th century in terms of this kind of graphic. And then since she's a saint of the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church, there are lots of, you find her in a lot of churches, and a lot of churches are named after her. If we get tired of looking at them, we can turn them off. So, yes, please. This is in Ephesus in current-day Turkey, so, or what would be ancient Asia Minor. About 5th century, probably, or in the 400s. There's not much of anything painted. We really don't have anything from the 2nd or the 1st century that's in painting.
Hal, there's one question here.
Please.
Can this be focused any better, any sharper?
I think not on my computer. I'm...
Like this?
I'm fairly sure, well, I don't know. Could you say a little bit more about that?
When we walked in, I thought this was clearer. I thought it was better focused.
Uh-huh.
But anyway.
I apologize. Yeah, my memory's probably also unclear. Barb?
Did this art last the Ottoman Empire, or was it... found recently?
It was found at the beginning, at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, was when it was excavated. Right. So that's toward the tail end of the Ottoman, I think, right? Yes?
Could that be Thecla looking in the window, like the story, or does it have to be out?
The traditional translation is that is from the story. That is, she's in story. She's looking out as a young girl at Paul. Was that my question? Or the other question? Okay. So let's go do our usual thing. Have thoughts, protests, and questions from you about the very full session. Yesterday. You know what? I'm noticing I can't see you when that's on. It's all right if I turn them off?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thoughts to begin our time? Puzzlings from yesterday? Yes.
At the time that Paul wrote Corinthians that we read yesterday.
Yeah.
What was the feeling of the church towards celibacy at that time?
I mean, basically, I don't know, and I don't think my colleagues know much. It's so early. I mean, this is one of the earliest books we have at all. There is some evidence of so-called celibacy, this kind of a practice in Judaism that's earlier, or in the tradition of Israel. Basically, some around this time and a little bit before, of people of Israel that are living in Egypt. There are occasionally earlier in the two centuries, you'll find someone being an in some kind of ascetic practice. It's not, doesn't seem to be as articulated as it is in Corinth, and that may be why Paul is so confused and trying to figure out what to do. It's not a main phenomenon. Yes.
Is it, I mean, just to build on that, I mean, is it responding to Jesus' modeling? I mean, there are gospel texts about him making others his fictive kin. And he's a substantial adult, and there's no reference to him being married.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
And we talked a little bit about this yesterday. A number of us think that Jesus was married, because everybody else was in Galilee, or that's everybody else. But that's a good point. It's clearly, the Acts of Paul and Thecla allude to Jesus as a model celibate. So there's that passing reference. So certainly in the eyes of this, of this late second, early late first, early second century document, Jesus is already seen as a celibate example. But the second century itself is full of controversy about Jesus's own relationship to marriage and family, with a number of people wanting him to be in family and a lot of them not. So far your questions are not getting good answers. Yeah.
Just a data question. A couple. There's reference at the time that she is going to be face martyred, one, she makes the sign of the cross. Now, I don't know if that's in our traditional way of doing it. And the other, there's a reference, she baptizes herself, and she says, at the last day.
Yeah.
Which sounds to me something like the practice of being baptized just before you die,
mm-hmm.
which I know is the case with Constantine, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the dates of when those practices started?
Yeah, sort of. So the let's see. The first question was
the sign of the cross.
The sign of the cross. That's very surprising. That she does that in this, if it's in the first century. There is a little bit of cross signs in the second century. But this makes me think that this version of the text is mid-second century, because that's where you find more of them. It's not that there are a couple of things in Ignatius of Antioch, and he is dated either early second or middle second century of the sign of the cross. It's funny because we don't have any pictures of crosses until the third century. So that is very puzzling. Now, then while we're on that, we're going to the baptism. The last day, I think it's read multiply because it could be her last day that she's living, and it could be a reference eschatologically of the last days that the earth will exist. I tend to think it's probably both, and a kind of a double meaning. I think that the plot of the story has her asking to be baptized before. So I think this is probably not a sign of that, since she sees to see it as a part of her ministry, something to get her going in her ministry. And some people, some scholars even think that she sees her baptism as a protection, as a woman in public. So that would tend to say, no, this isn't about a last minute baptism, and partly because that's also mostly later. But, you know, 1 Corinthians 15 has an allusion that also might be the case as early as 1 Corinthians. So that's just a reading from inside the text that the baptism is a deal before this. And again, late 2nd century, Tertullian and Irenaeus are really angry at the story itself because it has these two things, the activity of a woman baptizing anyone, much less herself. So even in the late 2nd century, the people that are trying to say we're the leaders, question whether they are, they are not happy with this picture of her.
You talked yesterday about the writings of Paul being earlier than the Gospels.
Right.
And therefore, Paul might not have known the story of the crucifixion, although he knew about the crucifixion. And so Paul was not basing his teachings on what he knew about, any stories necessarily that he knew about Jesus. Whereas when the Gospels were written, somehow there seemed to be an implication that I got from yesterday's discussion that perhaps the Gospel, well, and then also you talked about the Gospel being addressed to particular audiences, and the writers wanting to get their point across to different audiences. Is it possible that the stories in the Gospel about the crucifixion are made up stories?
The about was, I get the question, and actually that's the answer that I have too. let's go over that because it's so so interesting the way we have been taught to overlook differences in Scripture and try to find the commonalities. And I myself am very eager to look at the differences, not because that somehow makes them less valuable, but because it makes us more aware of different kinds of meanings that are being made. But I would say, so the literature, the scholarship between 1960 and 1990 worked exactly on your question. Or I guess I want to say, it was backwards. They came up with your question after a generation of working on trying to find out what really happened at the crucifixion. And there, what is found is that each of the Gospels, sometimes in different ways, use the Hebrew Scriptures to be elements of the actual story. So, for instance, there are about four different events in the story of the resurrection in different Gospels that come straight out of Psalm 22. And when you look at Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me, for instance, that means in the setting of Psalm 22, that is about an an indebted person who's being surrounded by people who are collecting his debts, and he's crying out to God, God, you helped my mom and dad, why can't you help me now? And then he's surrounded by these people, even taking the shirt off his back and bargaining for the last things they can get out of this indebted person. So in other words, it looks like Psalm 22 is a beautiful song of someone indebted, crying out to God. So we know it has its own integrity as such. But then the people in the writers in the first and second century pick up on those things and make them Jesus's in the crucifixion. So the by and large, what I've learned from the generation before me is that this means that Psalm 22 was also being used as a prayer by the early Christians because they were so poor. In other words, so they knew it. And then when they got around to writing what the story of Jesus's crucifixion might be, they didn't say, let's go research it. That would have been impossible anyway. And this was one to three generations after Jesus died anyway. But what they did is they filled those stories with other with meanings that they have in their daily life. So that when you would read Jesus crying out, my God, why did you abandon me? You feel like you're in the story because you've already been praying that about your own abandonment. And again, remember, day before yesterday, I said one of my main teachers, John Denny Luther Cardinal, said, thank God they didn't write down what happened. Thank God they wrote down what it meant to them. So it's not just Psalm 22. There are about 20 different references, major references, in the various stories of Jesus' crucifixion that come from the Hebrew Scriptures. So that's one of the main things that my predecessors learned about the composition of the crucifixion stories in the six or seven Gospels that we have that have that. So that's why I would tend to say your question in that right is should be answered in the affirmative, not because it making it up is a bad thing for them, but because it's the way stories work. I mean, really, for all of us, whether we're watching a movie, a good movie, or whether someone's telling a story 2,000 years ago, we put ourselves into the story, and it helps us make sense of our lives. Am I close to your question?
Right. So how did the writers, the writers of the Gospels, didn't necessarily witness
They don't even claim to. There's nothing in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that say, I saw it.
So everything that they wrote was based on the oral tradition.
Well, what I meant to say is some of it is based on oral tradition and some of it's based on their own spiritual meaning that they see in Jesus' crucifixion. And I think you can often see those meanings being built, for instance, by Paul. Of how do we think about Jesus being tortured to death? And Paul really makes active meaning without making stories. He says, look, it means this. I'm crucified with Christ. So that's a little bit of progress. Yes.
Will you say a little bit more about what, like, the theological understandings of baptism would have been at that time? Like, I know there were multiple, and I know that Thecla's baptism was controversial, but like, what were other folks imagining about baptism.
Yeah, I wish I could have a better answer. Yeah, there is really a lot of differences, even in the first century. And just a very quick, so baptism comes from practice of Israel's mikvah. That is a process that the people of Israel use to cleanse themselves. And it's a regular practice. What is really important to know is that if you are a non-Israel person and you want to become a follower of Israel's God, meaning if you want to convert, we all remember what the men have to do, right? Circumcision. Anybody know what the women have to do? Take a bath. So it's fairly possible that, in other words, if I am an Egyptian woman and I want to begin a relationship with Israel's God, there's that what I do is I take a mikvah. I take a regular bath and I am cleaned to be a part of Israel. What's really a good possibility is the Christ people as people of Israel, because probably the first 200 years of those people think of themselves as belonging to Israel, even when they're not born that way. They also began to say, if there's a rite of initiation or a party to celebrate me coming into relationship with the God of Jesus and Israel, I, male or female, it would make more sense, shall we say, or less pain, to have all of those people become parts of Israel by taking a bath, by having a mikvah. So that's one of them. Paul, on the other hand, says two things about baptism. He says, I don't do any baptisms. I never did. And then all of a sudden you remember, oh, I did a couple. but so there's a bit of Paul which is saying, I'm not sure about baptism at all. But then in Romans 6, which is later, he uses the meaning of baptism as dying and rising with Christ, which is quite different than being clean to be a part of the community. So those are two different, even in the very first parts of the first century. And it seems like as you go into the second century, it's not as if some authorities, because there aren't central authorities in the second century, get it all together, but actually the meanings of baptism multiply. So when you see in the third and fourth centuries people, there you have authority that's somewhat centralized, or at least regionalized. There they're saying, can we really get our act together and agree on what it is? Because it's in the third and fourth century when you really start arguing about the meanings of baptism. See what a bad answer that is. All right, well, let's go on to get into some other things we've been trying to work towards today. So we saw the grotto of St. Paul. I just wanted to say I've been avoiding your questions about a New Testament. So just to say a couple of things about that, because we've been studying the translation of the Acts of Paul and Thecla from a New Testament, this book that I put together along with 19, and by the way, all of the photocopying is from it. I worked for a couple of years with 19 different spiritual leaders around the country, bishops, famous scholars who were interested in spiritual meanings like John Dominic Crossan and Karen King and Barbara Brown Taylor. People who had led denominations, so we had leaders from the Presbyterian and United Church of Christ, Three Roman Catholics who had had offices in the, at the Vatican. And so what Houghton Mifflin Harcourt allowed me to do was take 75 of the new documents from early Christ groups that had been discovered in the last 150 years. And with these group of 19 spiritual leaders from around the country who were known for what they recommended to read, we got to study those 75 together. Most of them didn't even know anything about them, but they agreed to study for a year with me. And then at the end of that, I asked them, if you could add any of those 75 new documents that have been discovered from the earliest part of Christ movements, which ones would you add? And so those 19 people, I had one vote, everybody had one vote. And you, and so a New Testament adds new documents to the existing New Testament. So we ended up adding 10. The Pope, we asked Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the big time publisher, how many can we add? They said, as many as you think are good. And so we were very conservative. And we had lots of nice fights, but ended up being friends about which ones to add. And so we added 10 to it. And so this is a way of thinking in our time about how one can see what I call the greater family of scriptures in the first two centuries of Christ movements. So we added 10, and Acts of Paul and Thecla was one of them. I think it was the fifth best vote-getter.
Can you briefly comment on your retreatment of the existing New Testament books? I mean, how are they treated? Well, I think I read in the, it's not NRSV, it's Open English Bible, something that you're working from.
Yeah.
So can you say a little bit about that?
Just a little bit. So by and large, I think the council of these 19 people in general agreed that there was, that the existing New Testament was powerful and flawed. So for instance, for me, I would say, it's hard for me to lend much credence to 1 Timothy, which mostly is in the business of insulting women. So 1 Timothy says that women are saved by
childbirth.
And says all kinds of really mean things to women. So that's in the New Testament. And it belongs in the New Testament for various reasons, but one wouldn't want to take one's money to that bank, as far as I'm concerned. At the same time, they're just amazingly powerful things for us today in the existing. So we tried to say, we're going to try to add 10 that we know are flawed and that might have powerful meanings. So when these bishops and things that were working with this text, when they would ask me what are the criteria, I would say, your criteria, you're well known in the American public, you should tell them the best things to write for their own spiritual welfare. Am I near your question, Peter?
Well, I was just kind of curious, so you're including all those existing books.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and I write an intro to each of them
too. Okay, yeah, so that's some of the retreatment, is to introduce them and comment on them. But the actual verses in those books, they're, I think, was it the English Open Bible?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So why that and not NRSV? And is there some retreatment of verses? I think in the introduction it said you could retreat some of the verses and say, this is a fresh look at this. Inclusive language, for example.
Yeah, thank you. We, by and large, we're very conservative about inclusive language, even though I'm for it all. But we didn't follow me in that. We were going to use the NRSV, But we discovered this wonderful and horrible thing about the NRSV. The wonderful thing is, of course, that it is a great translation. The other wonderful thing is that all of the prophets from the NRSV go to, anybody know where all the prophets go? To the National Council of Churches. So the National Council of Churches makes huge amounts of money on the NRSV, and I frankly think I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. It turned out that it would cost us $600,000 to pay for printing the NRSV, because they knew that this was going to be selling to hundreds of thousands of people. So they have their rates according to how many people are going to buy it. Mm-hmm. So we just were too poor. I mean, even after a big publisher was bankrolling, bringing all these bishops and things together for all year, they finally said, "Are you kidding me?" So we couldn't. Mm-hmm. And so we had to find one that was pretty good and pretty cheap.
Okay. And it's pretty comparable.
Oh, and the other thing it did is this translation, which was initially done at the beginning of the 20th century, and has a copyright, an open copyright by a man in Australia, they said you can change anything you want. We didn't have enough time to retranslate everything. That would have taken 5 or 6 more years. Mm-hmm. So we did occasionally find, so for instance, we mostly changed the word Christos, which is translated usually transliterated to just Christ, but doesn't mean, what it means is the anointed one. So we did actually put in the real translation of Christos almost everywhere. Not everywhere. The translation, the head of translation found some places in which she thought that Jesus Christos was a name, not a word. And there she kept Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so lots to talk about in that regard, but that's the short version.
Could you talk a little bit about the original canon? And how that came to be?
No. thank you. If you're here next week, I'm going to give a whole lecture on this book. But there is a chapter in a New Testament that gives the story of the coming into being of the canon. And I can tell you, in writing that chapter, I just about fell over 20 times how much my seminary and my churches had just not told the truth about the way the canon came into being. But since that would be at least the next 20 minutes, I'm sorry, John.
That's okay.
Right. You will get a no out of me sometimes. Yes.
Do you personally really wanted to have in there that you get
older? Yeah, I only got 5 of the 12 that I wanted in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's this footnote in it about the ones I really wanted. I wrote it down at the beginning of the 3.5 years of work, and I thought, I'm going to just write down what I want now. and it was great to lose. Yes.
In the list that made it, the Gospel of Thomas is included.
Yeah.
And it's been a good source, at least in part, for trying to understand the sayings of Jesus. Mm-hmm. But it also is brutal toward women.
It is. 1:14 is. Yeah.
Yeah, as it closes out, Peter wishes Mary were a man, and that sort of thing. And that salvation is really free.
And then Jesus tries to defend Mary in a terrible way. I mean, Peter says in Thomas 1:14, she's not worthy of life.
Yeah.
And Jesus says, don't worry, I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to make her a man. But anyway.
So well, my point is, so that the sentiments about that, you would share the same sentiments about that book as you do, say, First Timothy or something like that.
Well, frankly, on a whole, I like Thomas better than First Timothy, but they're both significantly flawed. Okay, so enough of that. Let's talk about the Paul and Thecla and these terms Jesus and Christ. It's so interesting to see that. So the term Jesus, as far as I can tell, is never used simply in the Acts of Paul and Thecla. It's always Jesus Christ. So that's different, for instance, than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which almost only use the term Jesus. And it's more similar to Paul, which will often use the term Christ. We can't go too far down that rabbit hole. But just think about, so what does it mean? What does Jesus or Christ mean in the Acts of Paul and Thecla? And or, what does it mean to the communities that are devoted to Thecla? So this is a short way of saying, I'm not sure, but it feels to me as if I know that there are several times in which Jesus' kindness and Jesus' teachings are what Thecla is following. So it says, and it's mostly Paul is telling other people in Thecla about Jesus' teachings and Jesus' kindness. And then actually a third thing would be Jesus is wanting people to be celibate. So for instance, in those long beatitudes of chapter 5 and 6, I just call your attention to a couple of them. Blessed are those who observe purity in flesh, for they will become a temple of God. It's hard for me, given the rest of the story, not to think that that's about some kind of new genderedness and celibacy. Blessed are those who set themselves apart from the world, for they will please God. Blessed are those who have wives as if they do not. That's almost straight out of 1 Corinthians 7, right? I mean, sort of that kind of loosening of having wives and husbands. So it looks like Jesus stands... And then the most interesting one, I think, is chapter 6, verse 4. Blessed are those on the journey to uniting with Jesus Christ, for they will be the light. So this seems to point out that some people are on a journey of following Jesus more than others. And that might be, again, as we're talking, that might be that that Jesus is represents this new kind of celibacy. So Jesus is kind. Jesus may be celibate, it's not Jesus, it's Christ. Jesus or Jesus Christ, or Christ, are those things, and Jesus is a teacher. The curious thing for me is that the only teachings of Jesus Christ we have, no, they're not really teachings, they're Paul's teachings, they're Paul's Beatitudes, who mention Jesus. So we actually don't get any, the Acts of Paul and Thecla doesn't cite any teachings of Jesus directly, although says that following Jesus' teachings is important. Given the focus of this text on Thecla not wanting to be married, that seems to be implicitly what Paul and Thecla see in Jesus. But it never says that directly. So this also might be seen more like Paul, the actual letters of Paul, in that the actual letters of Paul also rarely talk about Jesus' teachings and never about Jesus' deeds except crucifixion and resurrection. So this could be just a long trajectory in which you you focus on Jesus' teachings, but they aren't written down much. So that means Jesus Christ, which I think is the preferable name inside the document, Jesus Christ, you need to follow his teachings, but you aren't told what they are unless they're mostly around this gender-bended celibacy. So I'm asking you more of the question than the answer, right? So what would you make, what do we make of this? Or another question would be, so how important is Jesus? Jesus is mentioned at least 10 times. Sometimes in passing, sometimes with unidentified teaching. All right, you know, yet another time I failed you. Working with this text for about the last 15 years, I just need to sort of teach you that that's a really interesting set of open questions. Protests, thoughts, pleas. Nick?
Is it possible that Jesus discovered the truth that people didn't want to say because they were convinced that what was written was all true? And he found some underlying truths that needed to be verbalized and then died for it because he spoke out. Mm-hmm. And people later said, but he was right.
I don't find myself wanting, I think all of what you just said is yes, but what I'm noticing is the specifics are a little vague. The other thing that is about the teachings of Jesus, when I think canonically, one thing I know is that Jesus is really different in John than Jesus is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So, you know, Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is always telling these pithy sayings, parables, aphorisms, and the like, in short little statements, Jesus hardly ever talks about himself in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I mean, Matthew, Mark, and Luke talk about him, but he seemed kind of shy about talking about himself. In John, Jesus talks in long speeches about how tight he is with God the Father and doesn't really have any parables or aphorisms in it. So I want to know, is the Acts of Paul and Thecla finding following John or Matthew, Mark, or Luke? Or none of the above? Or Paul? So,
well, if it was written before the Gospels, how did they know the stories?
I'm not sure.
I thought you said that the Goth, the this.
The Acts of Paul and Thecla.
Acts of Paul and Thecla were written, as were the Pauline writings, before the Gospels were written.
Oh no, I must have misspoken.
Paul's
letters were. The Acts of Paul and Thecla were written almost certainly after everything except maybe the Gospel of Luke.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's much later.
So, the book, and I just have read Thecla once through, but maybe it's something like the Book of Esther, which is another book that has almost no reference to God, and yet it's a telling of a hero of faith, without reference to God.
Yeah.
So,
I love the direction of your suggestion, and I want to follow you a little bit longer, and also then raise some questions about it. What if the key thing in this book is Thecla? Like the key thing in Esther is Esther.
Yeah.
It's not as if the Bible isn't full of other books, like focusing on other people as the key. So that's a lovely suggestion. I would want to say that God gets more than God's due in Thecla, in the Acts of Paul and Thecla. It's Jesus that comes up a little short. So for instance, she identifies herself as the slave of God. And really, there's just, I would say there are maybe 50 mentions of God throughout, rather than, if you squeeze it a little bit, you get 10 of Jesus Christ, Jesus and Lord Christ. So, in other words, I don't think that this book is short on God at all. But your point is still, I think, agreeable. Yes?
Is there a influence or connection between the Gnostic understanding of Jesus and the Gnostic understanding of the Christ? And I know there's debates as to when, you know, Gnosticism is kind of a broad picture, and when the dates and that all began, and all. But the notion that Jesus is the material one, and the Christ is the divine power one, and if one is thinking about celibacy and maintaining the celibacy, the Christ factor is going to be stronger than the Jesus factor.
I also love that. I think we should just keep that on the table as a really nice possibility. The other differences between Jesus and Christ in canonical literature is that Paul likes Christ more, using the word Christ more than Jesus. And the Gospels tend to like to use the word Jesus more than Christ. But I think your distinction is very helpful.
Well, I don't know if not all scholars agree, but that question seems to be at least entering into the minds of the Johannine literature, First John in particular, it was, unless you believe that Jesus the Christ came in the flesh,
right?
You know, rather than say a descended baptism and a departure before crucifixion kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I just was wondering if that is in the mind of the author.
Okay, whether again the larger picture would be where literature is thinking about Christ is more spiritual, and therefore is it possible that maybe the emphasis on Christ a little bit more than on Jesus would be would hook up with the rejection of marriage, which would be more material. So let's jump, I'm going to go one step further. Let's just take Christian and Christianity also in this text. So this is really fun for me especially, because it turns out that one has a hard time finding the word Christian at all in the first century. The word Christian is found three times in the New Testament. Isn't that interesting? I mean, only three times. The main one that's used is the one in the book of the Acts of the Apostle, where the word Christian is used as to define a group that is following the way. So this there are two or three uses of Christian in the Acts of Paul and Thecla, which tend to make us say it's probably second century, because the word Christian is used not very much in the second century, but more than in the first. And before we leave the first century, I want to say that it feels to me as if, because it's just barely used in the New Testament, that in the New Testament is written mostly in the first century and some in the second, at least most scholars think. And that would mean that there probably isn't such a thing as Christian per se in the first century, and maybe not of the much in the second. There's a little bit of use of this book that you get two or three mentions, depending on how you read it, of Christian. That makes it a interesting question as to whether it's later. One of the main thoughts, as people are trying to figure out when Christian becomes something serious about these movements of the Jesus and the Christ, is that it looks like almost always the word Christian first appears in the second century relative to those that are being killed. So for instance, there are a number of places where you're called Christian if you're killed for following Jesus. So I guess maybe 25 uses of the word Christian in the second century. There are probably a few more. But most of them are about being killed or about being threatened to be killed. And you'll notice it's the same here. That is when Thecla is, when they're talking. Oh, yeah, so I love this one in 16. Where Thamyris and Hermogenes and Damas are trying to get Paul killed. Say he is a Christian, and then you will destroy him. So there's a really decent chance that Christian is a negative name that's used to get people in the movement killed. So one of the things that the Christian could be an insult used by followers first. Followers against the movement. Here's an example. For instance, the other use of Christian in the Gospel, in the Acts of the Apostle. Oh, I'm stopped. I'll finish that sentence. The other use of the Acts of the Apostles in of Christian is when the person who's arrested Paul and is interrogating him He says, "Are you a Christian?" And Paul won't answer. Paul sort of says, "Well, you say so. If I were a Christian." Here it looks like Acts of Paul and Thecla is naming Christian as a contestant's label that has to do with the danger of being killed. We can talk about that more tomorrow. If some of you come tomorrow, please come with sort of what you make of the whole book now, or what you make of the figure. So this is our last chance, right? Tomorrow. Take a little walk, if you would, and say, so does it matter? Does Thecla matter, and how, or why not? Or something like that. And I promise to try to be better about getting good answers to you. Mm-hmm. Not on that question, but I'll tell you how I think Thecla is and isn't important. Thanks so much.